In today's episode of the Debt-Free Mom Podcast, we're talking about medical expenses. How do we get ahead with the other goals we have for our money when we constantly feel like we are paying for medical expenses that happened a long time ago? Sarah Gonzalez, a mom of two, comes on to talk about how she is going about paying off past medical expenses and reworking her budget so that she doesn't have to keep going into debt for medical bills. All right, Sarah, welcome to the show. Thanks for being willing to come on and do this and talk about something like money. I know that's not always easy for everybody. So what we want to talk about today is medical debt and paying for medical bills while you're trying to do other things. So can you just give us a little insight into what brought you to this place of asking a question like this? What maybe goals were you trying to do that then had to be like sidetracked or paused because of medical bills?
Sure. So just kind of like a scenario without getting into the weeds too far. We had a baby 20 months ago. And so we had medical bills still from labor and delivery. And then he had been hospitalized a couple of times. And also my children have no major medical issues. This is just general ear tubes.
Regular being a
Your
person.
Your kid has a sickness. You got to go to the doctor. I mean, obviously people who have major issues are in a different financial situation. As far as that goes too, but we're fortunate that that's not the case. But a lot of times, at least in the experience that we have, so we live outside of Milwaukee, the experience that we have here, a lot of the providers, you get two bills from them. So it's one's from the provider themselves and one's for the facility. So for one visit, you can often end up with two bills that are, you know, being charged separately. So we have two kids, and between my bills from my labor and delivery and the two boys being one needed a specialist and one had been in the ER, we found ourselves with debts or balances due to 10 different providers.
Hmm.
So, you know, we called and made the arrangements and made payment plans with all of them. But even with that, at 10 different providers, we found ourselves last summer in a place where we were at $840 a month in the minimum payments to each of these providers. So obviously that's a big chunk of money and that eats up your budgets. Or, you know, eats into your budget or anything extra that you had quickly.
Yeah. So do you have a high deductible insurance plan?
We do. A non-copay plan. So you have to pay your high deductible. And then to just kind of like unique to our situation, we have changed insurance providers through my husband's employer the past 2 years in the spring. So we've ended up with medical charges on the previous insurance changed. Started all anew with a new deductible. So that's what's kind of added to this situation for us in particular, because we're now having to double pay some of these things, which is not the case for everybody, but people do switch jobs and change their insurance.
Yeah.
At different times during the year. And then you're kind of on the hook.
So you're kind of paying off the old stuff, but then also your deductible reset when you switched from one company to the next. Yeah.
Correct. So it's kind of hard to like get caught up so that you can be proactive instead of continuing to be reactive to the stuff that's already happened.
Because if the payment plans are too long, then the likelihood that somebody else needs something before you've even paid off the other stuff is pretty high. It's like you said, not even if anybody's particularly sick, just like being a kid, you know?
Correct. That's one of the things happened with my younger son is he needed tubes put in last year and we were on a payment plan for that. And he happened to need them replaced this year before, I mean, it hadn't even been 9 months. So we're now on the hook for two bills within a 12-month period of time from the same provider for the same service, just on two different dates of service.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness. Yeah. Do you have or even have the option for like an HSA?
So that is one of the things that we do now with my husband's employer that he just got switched to this year. That is an option. Something that we don't know very much about. So it's something I know it is an option and a benefit. We just haven't explored it to know the full benefits and how it can be beneficial to us.
So with how much you're paying a month in medical bills, basically the way that it works is it's a way to earmark a set amount of his salary into a bank account that can only be used for medical expenses. But as long as it's used for medical expenses, it's not taxed. So like if he puts $1,000 into the HSA out of his paycheck, then that $1,000 is not taxed. So the dollar benefit of it to you can actually come right away if he sets that up through his employer, in the same way that, like, if he has a 401k or something like that, it operates the same way if the employer is offering the HSA as well. So, like, for example, if he would start putting $200 out of every paycheck into the HSA, his paycheck would go down by less than $200 because it would be not taxed. So the tax that had been going in there would be less. And then an HSA is simply a bank account. Like, you can get a debit card directly with it and you can pay medical bills out of the HSA. So you would not have to contribute to the HSA and be paying off these medical bills. You could start putting money into the HSA and immediately start using the money that was going in there to keep paying for these payment plans.
And you can take them to a different employer, correct? Like, if you change jobs?
So an HSA is a bank account that belongs to you, even if it's offered through an employer, for example. Like, we had one with Kyle's job, and before he left the job, the employer actually stopped offering a high deductible plan, so we weren't on it anymore. And once you're not on a high deductible plan, you can't add money to the HSA, but you can continue to use it. Like, the money is yours, and you can use it for medical expenses. So we had the HSA for a while after, like, that plan was all done and we were able to still use money out of it. And now we're back to having an HSA through being self-employed and having an insurance plan that is high deductible. And it's simply, like I said, it's a bank account with our name on it. And I have a debit card with it. If I go to pick up a prescription, I use that debit card and that money comes directly out of the HSA. And then if you're able to set it up through the payroll of the company, then those tax benefits, like I said, will happen right away. For someone like me being self-employed, we just put money into the HSA all year. But then at the very end of the year, when we file the taxes, we report how much we put into the HSA and it lowers our overall taxes at the end of the year. So it kind of depends on, but like if the high deductible plan through his employment, if they have also sent home paperwork or sent emails out saying, like, hey, this is an HSA that you can do, then it's most likely that you can set it up directly with their payroll to be able to start seeing those tax benefits immediately. So that would definitely be something to look at, because you're already paying those medical bills anyways. So it's not even like, oh, well, you know, it would feel like our income is going down because now we're going to start putting the money in the HSA. It would still be the bills that you're already paying. It would just be a way to pay those bills with pre-tax dollars instead of post-tax dollars, which can be, if you're talking about hundreds of dollars a month, that can make a pretty big difference in the paycheck. So it has an annual, right now, the annual contribution to an HSA for a family is, I believe, $7,850 in a year. So that's as much as you can contribute to it. But unlike an FSA, the flexible spending account, I don't know if you've had those before, but those dollars in an FSA, they do not carry over year to year. Like, it's like a use it or lose it. In an HSA, the money stays in there and belongs to you. So even though there's a limit on how much you can put in there within 1 year, you can allow it to accrue over time. The money doesn't disappear at the end of the year. So that's something I thought of right away when you were saying that, was because you're already paying money towards medical bills, you wouldn't have to be like, oh, well, now we have to pay $800 in medical bills and we have to figure out a way to contribute to the HSA. The exact same amount that you're already putting to medical bills could just be tax advantaged instead of post-tax. So I would definitely look at that. The HR at wherever he works would be the first place to go to ask about that. And they can either tell you, like, oh yeah, we have an employee sponsored account, or no, you just go find your own and you open it. Mine is through Fidelity. A lot of banks will just have an HSA that you can open. So that's the first one I thought of. And then, do you have an emergency fund of any kind? Have you saved one up? Have you had to use it for medical bills? Where are you at with an emergency fund?
When we first got into this predicament, I'll say, we did not. We've been able to get an emergency fund started. It's not to the level that we would ideally like it to have, but we also haven't been able or haven't needed to tap into it. Part of his getting a new job is an increase in income. So that's also helped to I mean, you kind of think it's like outweighing or balancing out that we've repaid the deductible and now we make more. So you're kind of coming out in the end. So thankfully, we have not had to keep tapping into the emergency fund, and we're able to keep it as itself and able to use our monthly budget to pay the bills. And there's a few, the amount, it was 800 at its prime or highest. And there's a few that we've paid off since. And so what we're paying out of each month now has gotten a little bit lower, but still significant.
It's still big. Yeah. Yes, for sure. Because one thing I think of is when, you know, like a lot of times, so like you said, the medical payments are 0% interest. They're not charging interest. But at the same time, I think a similar problem or something we want to avoid in the same way that we want to avoid paying interest is that we also want to avoid that the entire gap between our income and expenses is going towards payments that we're locked into, which becomes a cash flow problem, basically. So that kind of seems like that's where you're at, is like, you know, we're not being charged interest. We're doing okay with the emergency fund, but just the sheer weight of all of the different bills is making you kind of feel like a hamster on a wheel, that no matter how much you keep paying, by the time you start knocking things off, something else gets added. And so there's no forward momentum at all. Would that be a fair description of where you're
accurate, at? Accurate, yes.
Okay. Because in those situations, like when I think of, you know, when I build somebody's budget and that's kind of the scenario that they're in, I then do look at, could we pause adding money to the emergency fund? And if we even just reduced a few little things temporarily, how could we pay off whichever bill is the smallest in order to free up that ongoing income the quickest? So not only, like, let's say one of the bills is $200 or something. Not only do we eliminate that debt, which is good, but we also then, whatever that minimum payment was, if it was $25 a month, we then indefinitely free up that $25 moving forward. So I would recommend, when we're in a cash flow pinch like that, I recommend listing the debts in order from smallest to largest and identifying which ones we would be able to pay off the quickest. Because even though there is 0% interest on those, if you have a smaller one that has these incremental saving, you know, or these smaller minimum payments associated with it, just adding a little bit on top of the minimum payment can really make it go faster than we feel like it will. And that can then decrease the amount of time that you have to spend paying off so many at the same time. So in those scenarios, sometimes it does take a little bit of a sacrifice of like, okay, we might need to give up or reduce a certain fund optional category for a really short period of time. But for example, let's say like with restaurants, if you decrease the restaurant budget by $40 a month, maybe you would only have to do that for 3 or 4 months in order to eliminate that first smaller bill, let's say. And then you could bring back that. You could say, okay, these are the amounts of time that we're willing to do this. Because I think what we can do is, it's a lot easier to stick to decreasing or pausing something that's fun when we know what the end date is. When we're like, I'm going to do this for a set amount of time, but as soon as I hit this benchmark, I'm going to bring that fun thing back. Not only does it make it feel easier because we know when it's going to end, but it also kind of motivates us because we're like, oh, if I got there 1 month faster, then that would be 1 month sooner that I could bring that thing back. And honestly, that's something that I've had to do with our finances while we were in debt, but also long after we were in debt. Like, it wasn't something that went away once we paid off all of our debt. It was more of a skill that we could pull and use, you know, multiple times in order to achieve different goals. So it's not just a uniquely like, oh, someone who's in debt has to do this. It's just like something that we can do regardless of what those goals are. So are any of the total bill, like if you looked at a bill, are any of them like under $800 in the total amount remaining due?
And that's where I've kind of in my own head a few times gotten stuck, like, oh, there's only $200 left. I should just pay it off. But then I think, okay, but what if we need that? You know, if the minimum payment's $25, well, what if we need that other $175 for something between here and there? And now I don't have to have given them more, but I did. And now we're stuck. So I've kind of gotten away from that, even though my tendency is to want to do that. But yeah, there is definitely a few that are getting towards the end that if they were paid off on the sooner end than later, that would free up, you know, $50 or $20 or $35, whatever the case may be.
And I think that's a question we have to ask ourselves when we don't have an emergency fund, because if I use it here, I won't have a way to pay for something that I don't yet know about. We ask ourselves that when we don't have money in savings, but that's a question that can have a different answer when we have money in savings. So for example, if that was true, like you said, normally the $25 a month minimum payment is there. Well, if I decide to pay $200 instead of $25, and then I get, you know, my car battery dies and that's $150, I'm going to be kicking myself that I could have used that $150 or whatever. If we pay the medical bill and we end up with the car battery dying, if we have money in savings that would be able to take care of that, we can decide to put that money towards that debt, because we know we're not actually putting ourselves into a corner that we can't get out of. If we had like true zero in our emergency fund, then we would be putting ourselves into a corner we couldn't get out of. But we get the privilege of being able to kind of filter through those decisions a little differently once we do have some money in savings. Our options can kind of expand. So if that's the case and you are able to, like in that scenario, I think that's a good hypothetical because that's a pretty common one. It's often a medical or a car, right? It's like one of those two tends to be the thing. Yes, exactly. So I think if you could think through like, okay, even if I went ahead and paid off the $200 and then the car or battery needed to be replaced, would I have somewhere that I could pull $175 from, for example? And if the answer is yes, I would go ahead and pay off the medical debt, because even if, you know, it's so one thing we think about too is like time to recoup our investment. So if the minimum payment is $25 and you're paying an extra $175 in order to pay it in full, that would be, let me do my math, that would be 7 months before we then kind of recover the extra $175. But you get to start feeling that freedom that immediately following the next month, because the next month you could take that $25 and apply it to your next smallest bill, and that bill is going to start going off faster. You don't have to take it from other categories at that point. Once you get the ball rolling, you know, like I said, you would maybe have to scale back a couple of those fun optional categories in order to get your first one rolling. But once we do that, we don't have to do that every time we're moving on to the next debt. The extra money that can start going to the next debt can just come from what the previous minimum payment used to be. So it's not like I have to continuously find ways to say no to ourselves in order to gain that momentum.
So one of the things that I also did, and now I'm kind of thinking to like retract what I started to do, is we have an emergency fund, but like I said, I would like it to be higher than it is, but there's something's better than nothing. So what I was doing when I would pay off one of the smaller ones, instead of taking that monthly payment and putting it towards the next medical bill, because they're still all 0%, I was taking it and putting it into my emergency fund. So now I'm thinking, instead of doing that, because I was like, at least then each time I'm still spending or allocating the same amount of money, but this time it's building something and keeping the rest of them the same. So now I'm kind of rethinking, maybe the better choice is to apply that one to the next bill and the next bill and the next bill, and then let the emergency fund be for now and let that build once you have all of these taken care of, and then go on from there.
And you can kind of do a mixed bag of both. I would set a number amount that I'm saying like, okay, this would be my minimum that I really need the emergency fund to be at. My goal for that is to try to be 1 month of necessary expenses. So not 1 month of income, but to actually like look at your budget and say that the best question to ask is, what are the bills we would continue to pay even if we had no income? So, you know, mortgage and food and insurance and things like that. What would we keep paying for even if our income stopped? Those would be our necessary expenses. If we add those up, that would be an ideal like starter emergency fund of 1 month worth of necessary expenses. If we can then get to that point, I really think that you can pause adding money to that, and you just know it's there. And if you need to use it, it is available to you. But we do tend to find more consistent momentum if we focus on one thing at a time instead of multiple things at the same time. So that's why I think having specific goals in mind with specific amounts can help us to say, I know what I'm working on right now, and I also know when I'm done with that and I'm ready to move on to the next thing. So maybe it is true that your emergency fund is a little bit underfunded and you kind of feel exposed to the risk of unexpected expenses. If that's true, then I do agree with what you said of taking that extra and adding it to the emergency fund until it gets to that full amount. But then once that is true, when you shift your focus to paying off the debts, keep that money that gets paid off and that used to be going to a previous minimum payment, keep it rolling into your next debt so that the timeline of paying those off continues to speed up. So a scenario where I would say the opposite would be if someone had a lot of cash flow, if they had a big gap between their income and expenses, so they have a large amount that they can put in savings per month, then in that case, I would just say, don't worry about your debt and just fill the emergency fund because it's only going to take a little bit of time. It's only going to take a couple months, for example. But if filling your emergency fund is going to take a really long time because of how much debt you have, then we might want to expedite debt payoff and say, okay, I can't let saving the emergency fund take 2 years. I need to have a bigger gap between my income and expenses. And in order to do that, one of the things I can do is get a few of these smaller debts paid off so that once I start focusing on my emergency fund, the gap between my income and expenses is bigger than it would have been if I had all that debt.
I think we're past that milestone, if you want to call it that, or initial marker of that 1 month. So now I think it's like, okay, now it's time to shift gears. We've gotten past that. We're like in that in between of the basic need for an emergency fund and an ideal. So we're somewhere in between. So I think it's kind of time to shift focus and just start to like knock some of them out. I think it is definitely though discouraging, like you said, when you haven't even gotten one like paid off or made a dent in it. And then you're like, adding to, and you're like, okay, I've been paying this for how many months and we're going the wrong direction with the total.
Yeah. And some of that is, you know, one thing that we talked about, we discussed a couple times in our Psychology of Money book is that you can do all the right things and there can just be external circumstances that can come your way that do not mean that you did anything wrong. So I think the example that you gave is perfect of like, if you tried to pay off a debt, you paid it off, and then you ended up having some other unexpected expense, it doesn't mean that paying off that debt was wrong. It just means that you did the best with the information you had at the time, and now there's new information. But it can be really easy to kind of kick ourselves and say, well, I shouldn't have done that, and that was a bad choice, and you know, I should have known to put it in savings. There's just things that we can't know ahead of time. And so even when that happens and you have to, like you said, end up getting a second set of tubes 9 months later, well, that couldn't be something that you could have predicted. So it doesn't mean that anybody did anything wrong. It's just the nature of life being super unpredictable. So sometimes, you know, if you have at least a month of necessary expenses in the emergency fund, that is light years away from what a lot of people often have, but it can be hard to allow ourselves to kind of rest in that and to say it is there, it is available, I can use it. I don't need to respond to my bills the same way that I did when I didn't have an emergency fund. I can be laser focused on these debts and just let my emergency fund sit. Like you said, for now, like eventually you have an ideal amount that you want to get up to, but you'll be able to get up to that ideal amount a lot faster if you can get out from a couple of these medical debts that are taking from your paycheck each time.
Yeah,
if that makes
and that's,
sense.
I think, resting. I don't want to say resting on your progress, but resting on like the emergency fund is here and you didn't have it, you know, how long ago. So now focus on other things. And to then, you know, if there's a tax return or a bonus or, you know, an influx of money, I don't want to say unexpected, but extra, then it kind of goes to that same question. Do we keep filling those or do we knock a few of these things off? And I was thinking differently before and I'm kind of changing my gears back to like, let's free up the monthly cash flow. And then once that's free and we have extra, then we start funding that emergency fund up to the ideal level.
Yeah. And that's definitely the thought process that I would go through too, is if you had a big gap between your income and expenses, so you're putting hundreds of extra dollars towards your goals every single month and it's really consistent. If that was the case, then when you get a tax return, I would say, yeah, just dump it in your emergency fund. You're getting closer to that ideal amount. But if we have that cash flow situation where we're like, man, these bills are really taking the extra that we have each month, then what we can do is use something like an influx of cash from a bonus or a gift or a tax return to say, if I pay off a couple of these debts, not only does it pay those in full, but it also frees up our budget moving forward to continue to add more to our goals. Where if you had all your exact same debts and you put your entire tax return into your emergency fund, it doesn't change what your budget looks like next month, right? You have all the identical bills that you did last month, where if you pay something off and a minimum payment goes away, it does change what your budget looks like moving forward.
Yeah. And I think that, I mean, kind of going to like the psychology thing, I've read the book. It kind of just like, you know, adds to your momentum, like feeling like, okay, we're making progress and now we have more fun money, or we can add more restaurant, you know, extra that we either weren't doing before or we'd cut back on, and now we can like add those things back in.
Sometimes, like, you know, even just like debt snowball versus debt avalanche, the debt avalanche is mathematically better, but the debt snowball is often the one that people can stick with because it gives them that quicker win. It gives a shorter period of time between when you commit to it and when you get to see a paid in full letter, for example. So sometimes those little choices that can help us see that what we're doing is actually working can be a much better choice than whatever some calculator would tell us would be better. So, but sometimes it's hard to make those, especially if we know what the calculator would say, then our brain is kind of like, well, you can't do that because that doesn't make mathematical sense. But it doesn't all have to make mathematical sense in order to be a good plan. So I think like having some of those things, you know, out from under you, even just the ability to log in and look at your budget and the list of debts used to have 10 items on it and now has 8 items on it, just little things like that. Like, it's okay to be like, that makes me feel good. I like that. That's what we're going
to
do.
And I would say definitely, even in, again, it's like your own, you have to kind of sometimes to trick yourself, or it's whatever works for you kind of thing. And there's parts of me that's like, you know, there's like 10 listed here and I want to pay, get rid of all of these, even though they're 0% interest, where this one, that's a car loan or whatever, you know, that's something that is being charged interest. That doesn't bother me because it's only one line item, but these 10 really get under my nerves, but that one is just fine because it's only one line item on the sheet, not 10 different payments to 10 different providers in different places. But.
Well, and that's why I like to kind of blend the idea of the debt avalanche and the debt snowball, because if we only looked at interest rate, or if we only looked at balance, sometimes we would say, like you said, if you have a car loan that has 8% interest and then everything else is 0% interest, well, the debt avalanche is going to say, don't even touch the medical debt until you pay the car. Well, if the car has a $17,000 balance, we're talking years between when we actually start paying off our debt and when we would even touch the other ones. And again, if someone does have a wide margin between their income and expenses, so they're putting a lot towards their goals, then that can be an okay approach. But if we're like, I really need to free up money month after month in my budget, then the best thing to do is to focus on those little ones that we can just get out of the way so that we unclog our budget, essentially, so that it's not going in so many different directions. If I was in that scenario of a bunch of 0% interest debts and then one big one that had higher interest, I personally would choose to pay off the smaller ones. And it's no small thing. Like, we shouldn't ignore the fact that once you pay those off, you've freed up like several hundred dollars a month. So by the time you then get to paying off the one that does have interest, the speed at which you're able to do that is multiple times faster. And that's a very valid reason to go ahead and focus on the medical debt first, even though it is 0%.
So the other thing I was going to ask you is, this is, you know, all like fixing what's already happened, or, you know, coming up to, with a solution to deal with what's already been done. And kind of with same thing with like the high deductible plan, like, you don't know when you go into the office for a visit, your kid has strep, or, you know, whatever the case may be, like what you're going to be charged for that visit going in. So it's harder if you don't have a copay plan, you know, okay, an office visit is $35. I know if I take my kid in for a sick, I'm on the hook for $35. And you just go in, I want to say kind of blind. And then you come back and you're like, oh, wow, that was a $300 strep visit or whatever the case may be. So it's a little bit, also I'm trying to figure out how to prepare for incurring the stuff. And my thought is getting it so that you have saved what up to what your deductible is, because you know that's what you're theoretically on the hook for, but you have to get there. It would be like a secondary to your emergency fund. So you still have to get to a point where you can stash that away to be prepared ahead of time.
I think the ideal thing to do is have an amount that you just decide every month you're going to put away towards medical expenses, whether they happen or not. And if you do decide to open an HSA, that could be an amount that you end up taking out of that, so that, like I said, it can be that pre-tax money, and then allowing that to build up. Because what we can say is, I don't know when we're going to get sick, and I don't know how much the individual bills are going to be, but I do know that we are going to pay for medical expenses throughout the year, right? Like, so it's unknown the specific amount and the specific date, but it's pretty known that there's going to be something. So I think looking at your budget and maybe that's what you do after you pay off, you know, like you decide, okay, if I pay off the two smallest ones, those minimum payments add up to $80. As soon as I pay those off, I'm just going to start putting $80 a month into either the HSA or into some secondary bank account that I call medical expenses, and just continue to do that so that when you inevitably have to go, even if that amount can't cover the full bill, it could offset it enough that you don't have to sign up for a payment plan where, you know, if the bill ends up being $300 and you have $210 in a medical fund, well, you could do that and then pay the $90 out of your regular budget or whatever it is. Because I do think that getting out ahead of that is important so that we can make sure that we don't have to sign up for a payment plan every single time somebody has anything. It takes a little bit of planning and a little bit of prayer that nobody gets sick for just a little bit of time, you know. I'm sure that you've done that before. Yeah, you're like, okay, I need a break.
I need just a little bit of time
to build up our savings. Yeah, hopefully with warmer weather, there may be a little more likelihood that that might be the case. But yeah, I do think that it is more wise to say, I'm just going to act like somebody's going to the doctor once a month than it is to say, I'm not going to put anything into savings for medical. And then once it actually happens, I'm going to try to take care of it after the fact. Yeah. And that will be over time, that will be one of your perks of building that emergency fund even higher, is that even when that happens, if the bill is even like $600, so bigger than just a one-time visit, you could pull the $600 from savings from your emergency fund and then just slowly replenish it instead of signing up for a payment plan that you're locked into having to pay them. Because I prefer to do that now that our emergency fund is full, because then I can decide when and how much I put in there each month in order to get myself back to where I was before, versus if I agree to a payment plan with a provider, once we set that up, then on that date for that amount, I have to pay them whether I have something else going on or not. So I do prefer, once I got to the full emergency fund amount, I do prefer to borrow from myself or set myself up on my own payment plan to replenish myself than to be locked into a payment, for example.
When it seems like there should be more left in your bank account and your money seems too complicated to keep track of, the Debt-Free Mom Custom Budget Service takes the guesswork out of your next budget. Send us your real numbers and you'll receive two versions of your pay period budget. The original, so you can see how your money is currently flowing, and a suggested budget with changes we recommend to prioritize your money goals. Sign up for your custom budget today at debtfreemom.co/custom.
So I have personally dealt with payment plans and stuff before for a while, because we've had high deductible plans or healthcare sharing ministry instead of insurance. And those have been our only two things. So I actually have never been on an insurance plan that was like a low amount, like copay or whatever. I've never had that. So because of that, we've had medical bills and larger payment plans. A few things I've done before are, if I have the cash to pay for it, I will call and ask if there is some sort of pay in full discount. Or with a high deductible plan, for example, I can say, you know, like, do you offer a cash pay discount where if I pay the bill in full today, could you give me 10% off? Could you give me 20% off? I would say that has about a 50 to 75% success rate, but it is very true that what is on your bill statement, they are not required to get every single penny of that from you. There is wiggle room. Sometimes it's luck of the draw, who you talk to or what the provider is. And sometimes they have a flat standard that it's like, oh, if that person is offering to pay in full, it's a standard 15% off or whatever. So I do that every time, even though I, like I said, half the time I'm told no.
It's worth it asking if you have it. And unfortunately, I've asked those questions, and with the providers that we are dealing with, unfortunately, that isn't the case. But I have asked, because it's like, okay, this isn't ideal, but if it would save me $200 total, we could make things mm-hmm. work. So yeah, I have tried that one.
The other thing I then do, if they say no, try to dangle the carrot of I'm offering to pay you in full. Like, remember, I'm saying that the bill is $1,000 and I'm willing to pay $800 today. If they say like hard no to anything, I then ask what's the longest payment plan that you'll give in order to make the a monthly amount lower. So another thing that you might be able to do is look at maybe a couple of them that have a higher monthly minimum payment than the other ones and call and say, I'm having trouble keeping this in my budget. I don't want to go to collections. I want to pay this bill off. Instead of a payment plan that's $120 a month, could we change it to a payment plan that's $50 a month? They still do 0% interest. They don't charge interest. So they're not going to say, well, yes, but we have to charge interest. So have you done something like that before?
I have. And again, I don't know if this is a newer thing or how recently you've had medical debts or if it's just the providers that we happen to be dealing with. A lot of them now are only 24 months. A lot of them, that's the max that can stretch it out without then there being some type of interest. And then you do have to apply for some type of like financial approval to have a payment plan that extends beyond 24 months. So I also have tried that.
Yeah. I wonder if sometimes if the first person tells you no, if you could ask for a supervisor and say like, can we do 24 months from right now? Because they have, I know they like to say that they can't, they have the mechanism in order to do that for sure. And it is more beneficial for them to work something like that out with you than it is for them to pay lawyers and collection agencies to go after that. So it hasn't been too terribly long, but it's probably been, let's see, January of 2023 was the last time I paid off a big medical bill payment plan. So just a little over a year.
Yeah, I think that's part of it. I guess the reason I was asking is because prior to like the past 2 years before that, when my older son was younger, which was 10 years ago. So that's why I hadn't had a lot of bills in that gap of time. So that's why I was like, has something changed?
Yeah.
Or is it just the people I'm happen to be working with? Or I just wasn't sure how.
Yeah, it could be like a COVID-related structure, you know, bill restructuring or something. Because, yeah, that influenced and changed everything. But yeah, sometimes, and like I said, sometimes it can be just the person, not even the provider, but just like the person that you talk to. Because, you know, even if, like you said, that they require it to be a 24-month payment plan, you could say, okay, well, I've been paying for 6 months. This monthly payment amount is really high. And I think being really honest, too, and saying, like, we had so many medical debts that the one plan that I'm talking to you about is 1 out of 10, especially if they're all in that network. So you owe one overall umbrella provider. You can be like, you can look at my account and you can see what I'm doing in order to get some of these, you know, smaller ones taken care of or whatever. I need just a little bit more margin in order to do that, which, you know, throughout our whole conversation, like that's the truth. That's what you're trying to do. And yeah, it doesn't always work, but it is a way. Or even just, can I lump them all into one payment that's, you know, that's different, that's a little bit lower or something. So yeah, it's not a surefire way to get, you know, like 100% sure that this will fix the problem, but it can be a way, even if they're only willing to do that on like one or two of them, it could be enough to give you, like we said, that little bit of initial momentum to get that ball rolling and pay those off, even if they're not super flexible with you.
Well, and it's always worth a shot. And it's a phone call, and most of the times it only takes, you know, 10 minutes at the most. So if it does end up saving you money, then it's worth. And like I said, this was at the peak and at the worst, and we've gotten some down. So we're in a little bit of a better. I've just chosen how to put the extra differently. So now it's just shifting gears back to looking at the highest one and paying it that way.
Yeah. And something to look at too is that depending on when the dates of all of them started, you might be in a situation where like a smaller debt actually has a bigger monthly payment than like a larger debt, you know, like if you're at the end tail end of one of those payment plans. So if you have like a couple of debts that are all similar in size, similar in total amount due, then choose the one that has the highest monthly payment out of those smaller ones. Cause that can also be like, well, it, you know, I could pay a $400 one off that has a 30 minimum payment, but I could also pay a $500 balance that has a $90 minimum payment or something. And, you know, and so focusing on the 500 first, because it's $100 more than the other one, but the minimum payment is triple what the other one is. That's something that I look at when I'm evaluating like custom budget debts, is where can I get the most bang for my buck, basically, is like which debt can I open the most in their budget by paying off the total balance. Okay, so to summarize, because you do have an emergency fund that would cover at least 1 month of necessary expenses, you can kind of shift your focus forward and say, I'm going to rest on knowing that if a large unexpected expense comes up while I'm trying to pay off the debt, it's okay to use the emergency fund, and I don't need to use every extra dollar each month to go into the emergency fund. I can allow myself to focus on these debts, and I'm going to list them in order from smallest to largest so that I can look at which ones can I knock off the fastest that would free up the most in my budget moving forward. In order to get that ball rolling, you might want to look at what your budget, what you could temporarily reduce or pause out of other categories just to get that initial momentum on some of the smaller ones, but you don't have to do that. The more we do that, the faster it goes, obviously, but that's not something that's a requirement. And then once you do that and start paying each individual one off in full, you're freeing up income for the future that could go towards other debts, but you could also use it to then, like you said, not only solve the problem of cleaning up what happened in the past, but also fix what you have to do moving forward when future medical bills come up, which is to have some kind of HSA or separate savings account that you call it medical, so that when those things come up, you've been putting money aside. Even if it doesn't pay the full bill, it can at least offset it. And I think even, you know, as we brought the psychology piece up a few times, having a separate savings account that says medical on it, to me, is so much better feeling than pulling money out of my emergency fund, even if it was all the same money anyways. So maybe, you know, if you're very like, oh, you know, as long as I never touch my emergency fund, then I'm fine, then I would recommend, I personally do have a separate savings account. Well, I did before I have an HSA. Now the HSA is my separate savings account. But before we had an HSA, I actually had a separate bank account and it was named medical expenses. And I put money in there so that I didn't have to feel like I was doing the wrong thing by pulling money out of my emergency fund, even though, like I said, I knew, like you said, we have to trick our brains. I knew.
Isn't that funny? Like the labels or how we word it or what we call it, it all matters to us. It all matters how we label it.
It does matter. It really does. It's
just better.
And it's so unique to each person. Like each person has a totally different way of going about it. But yeah, if you find that that applies to you too, like it did to me, of like, I would have no problem pulling money out of a savings account called medical versus called emergency fund, then maybe you want to do that too.
That's what I'm thinking, is like the plan moving forward to change the course from here on.
And while that does take a little bit of time, the thing you can do is, you know, if you're consistently adding money to a medical savings account or an HSA, you could decide a certain amount, like, okay, once it gets to $3,000, I don't need to keep adding to that. I'm going to go ahead and start focusing on paying off those other debts or building your emergency fund or investing. It doesn't have to be something that you perpetually, constantly add money to either.
Especially if you kind of get like a reprieve from the spending out of it and it's not being tapped as often, that would help too.
Yeah. And kids getting older kind of, you know, helps with that too.
I was going to say daycare kids, that's never... No. Never helpful.
No, yeah, you have that season, that initial, like once they first start school, where you're just like, okay, we're going to be sick from August 15th to October 1st, and then it'll kind of alleviate a little bit. Do you have any other questions that I can talk through with you or answer or anything?
I feel like this has been helpful. And like, again, I've had a custom budget from you before, or early, I think like last fall. And now that we're kind of like shifting gears, and like I said, you know, the job change was for an increase in income. So it's like, okay, we need to take this conversation that we did in like where we're at now with having an emergency fund and kind of reshift the priorities and like look back at my budget and I don't say start over, but kind of like reevaluate where we are now versus where we were when at the time when we had that made and decide what we what the priorities are now versus what they were then, because things have changed.
And the nice thing about having a tool like that is that you could play around with the numbers before you actually decide what you want to do. So you could look at that budget and update it so that it has, you know, now your current income and some of the medical expenses are paid off or whatever. And then you could say, okay, I wonder if we tweaked a couple of these categories and we instead put a little extra towards that debt, how many pay periods or how many months would it take to pay that off? Oh, that's too long. Let me do this instead. So it can give you a way to visualize how all those little changes would impact the big picture before you actually decide which path you want to go down. Well, thanks for calling in. I know that, first of all, you are not the only one who has a long list of medical debts that you're trying to pay off. So not only should it not be embarrassing or anything to talk about, but also like having other people be able to hear this conversation and hear what you are having to do, I know will also be helpful for others in the same boat who are like, where should I even send my extra money? So I hope it was helpful for you, but I also know that it'll be helpful for people listening.
Hey, this is Kyle here with Carly, and we're back for another segment of Financial Fortune Cookie. Last week when we debuted this segment, you had made a joke that I should put some theme music in here, and I did. Did you end up listening?
I did not. I have a confession that I very rarely listen to my own podcast. I was there for the recording. I knew what happened.
But you were not there for the edit.
I was not there for the edit.
That's where the magic happens.
Okay, well, I will go back and listen.
So for this segment, we are looking ahead at the future, all of the possibilities of what money could be down the road. And I saw an article recently, and the headline said, couple with $2.3 million net worth still worried about money. So my question for you is, if you had $2.3 million net worth right now, would you still be worried about money?
I wouldn't be. However, it wouldn't be purely because of the amount of the net worth. So that article to me is very proof positive of the concept that money by itself doesn't cause stress or add comfort. It's what you do with it and how aware of your plans you are. So for example, with someone who has a high income, like well over six figures, those people come to me pretty regularly asking for advice, asking for custom budgets, saying that they are ashamed of how much debt they're in. And it is a helpful exercise for me as I work with them to realize their income is much higher than mine, but the stresses that they are expressing are not something I'm experiencing. So it's given me the mental exercise of thinking through, why is that? And I think it's because when you are aware of where your money is and what you're going to do with it, that stress starts to alleviate before your net worth goes up or before your income goes up. Because I think we put a lot of stock in, if my income was higher, if my savings account was higher, I would just automatically feel better about my money. But there are ways to earn a lot of money and just stockpile it constantly, which might be what this high net worth family is doing, is just feeling the need to not spend it or to, you know, put it into things that they can't take it back out. And if we operate in that way, we're going to add stress to ourselves by being afraid of what could happen to that money if we don't have a specific plan. If we don't have a plan that is built around being flexible and being secure regardless of what the future holds. So if they're very afraid of the future, that is a red flag to me that they haven't really taken time to say, okay, well, if this unexpected expense came up, or if this emergency, or even something as large as if we lost our job, these are the contingency plans we would have in place. And planning that way can alleviate stress and fear of the future in a way that simply having money doesn't do by itself.
Yeah, it kind of reminds me of the transition that we made a few years ago when we were working to get out of debt. We were paying off our student loans and we had a small car payment. And, you know, we didn't have a lot of debt relatively to, you know, some, but we were really working hard to pay it off. And then
we did, for perspective though, if you think about it this way, our, at the time that we began paying off our debt, our total debt owed, we did not have a mortgage, so it was just student loans and car. Our total debt owed was over 50% of what our current income was in a year. So if people think, you know, if relative to their own current income, our debt to income ratio was high.
Yeah. Yeah. But as we were working on getting that paid off, we had that goalpost of when we're debt free. I don't think we ever articulated it, but we said when we're debt free, it'll be great. And we never thought about what's on the other side of that and how do we continue to feel secure. Obviously, when we made that final payment and we were officially, you know, debt free, it was a great feeling, but it didn't take too long for us to realize that was not a magical key to feeling secure in your finances. There's a lot of other pieces that come along with it in order to have that feeling of security, to not feel worried about it. And we weren't making, at the time, we were making very little between our couple of jobs, but we felt, we ended up after kind of developing some of the pay period budgeting stuff that had now turned into the basis of Debt-Free Mom. That's when we really turned a corner and started to be confident about where we were at, because we were able to see into the future and start to plan.
And somebody with a 2.3 million net worth probably is just experiencing that same kind of thing on a larger scale of like, oh, because we earn $400,000 a year, we're just not going to have money problems. Like, we're just not going to have stress about expenses. We're not going to be afraid of the future. And then there's this wide disconnect, or there's a wide gap between what they expect that income to feel like and what it actually feels like. And again, to me, that's just a indication that the money alone cannot provide that level of security, that it's what you do with it, that two people, two different households could each have a $2.3 million net worth, and one of them could be terrified and one of them could be completely secure, goes to sleep at night not afraid. And we like to, you know, those of us who have a much, much lower net worth than 2.3 million like to say, well, of course they sleep well at night. They have a $2.3 million net worth. But like I said, I've experienced working with people who have similar net worths and have completely opposite perspectives on how secure that makes them. And so this job has given me the gift of insight into different households' incomes, and not just their incomes, but because of what we do with the custom budget, we ask them, what are your goals and what are you frustrated about and what are you hoping to fix? I truly think it's a gift. I've had the gift of seeing people with incomes, multiple factors higher than mine, saying, I don't know how we're going to get through this. I don't know how we're going to pay this off. I don't know how we're supposed to be able to afford our life. And so it's given me a lot of contentment in where I'm at right now. And it's allowed me to fight back on the very natural feeling that we all have of, well, if my income doubled, I would be set for life.
Yeah. Yeah. So if you got to talk to this couple that has this big net worth and they're still worried about their money, what are like a couple of things that you would, like, practical, you know, back of a napkin, here's your plan to not feel worried about your money?
Yeah. So I think what it would take is an awareness of what you are spending and what that gap is between your income and expenses. Because a lot of times what that fear is this feeling or perception, because they don't actually know the numbers. So we just have a feeling that our expenses are going to exceed our income. And so because of that feeling, whether it's true or not, we operate out of fear. So they might be like, well, I don't know if we should go on that vacation or not, because I don't know if the money's going to be there. And if we take just a little bit of time to plan out how much money is available to us and what are we going to do with it, that stress alleviates, whether we're talking about someone with a 2.3K net worth or a 2.3 million net worth. I think at that income level or at that net worth level, you probably don't need a specific, like, category by category, pay period budget if they have income rolling in constantly, but some sort of mapping out of what are our priorities, where do we want that money to go? That would be the first thing, is fear about money while you have money. To me, the biggest indication is a lack of awareness. So that would be my first thing. And then my second thing would be something that I've talked about before that I learned in counseling when I was going through counseling for very crippling anxiety was even if statements. So asking them to actually name with specificity what they are afraid of. Because I think a lot of times we can get into this general, like, well, the future is scary and I'm just afraid of what's going to happen. And I would push back and say, what are those things? Like, name some things that you're actually afraid of, and not like even just saying losing my job is too general. Like actually saying, okay, well, what would happen if you lost your job, and pushing them back to so that they have to think through not just how would they feel, but like what are the physical actions that they would take if they lost their job, for example, because that exercise helps you to realize how many things you have to fall back on. So someone with that high of a net worth, you could say, okay, let's say you lost your job. The income stream is gone. Do you have money in a liquid savings account that's not invested, that's not in real estate, that you could use to cover all of your bills and expenses? And they probably do with that level of net worth. So then it would be talking through, okay, so you would give yourself the gift of 6 months worth of figuring out what you wanted to do next, or if you needed to even do anything next. So the even if statements are, for me, are like, oh my gosh, like our life would be ruined if we lost our job. What you could practice would be, okay, even if we lost our job, we have enough savings to live for 6 months. And 6 months is a lot of time to pivot and find what we want to do next. Okay, even if our investments values went down drastically, we would have an income stream that allows us to continue living while we wait for the stock market to rebound. So naming with very specific detail what the actual fear is helps to unveil what those fears are, because the more we feel afraid, the longer time we go feeling afraid, the more we blow things out of proportion. And that is with intimate personal experience. And so actually bringing them back to reality by saying, like, name what you're afraid of, and then let's talk about two or three different ways that you would be able to still be okay in spite of that fear, can help to bring us back to a point where we can be in problem-solving mode instead of that, like, very primal fight or flight kind of mode.
So if I were to summarize the stuff that you just said, if you're talking to this couple that has this high net worth, likely a high income, and has a high amount of fear and anxiety about their finances, first thing they want to do is get an awareness of their current financial picture. Know where their money's coming in, where it's going out, how much they actually have available to them. And then the second thing is being able to name what they are worried about in specific detail, because that leads you to the creation of an actionable plan to prepare for those anxieties.
Yeah. And I said in Instagram stories yesterday, and a lot of people really resonated with it, you can't solve problems you don't see. So if they just, like I said, if they just know that they have a 2.3 million net worth, and so they're trying to just rest in that without having an awareness of their expenses, without knowing what kind of cash is available to them versus locked up in income, that creates fear because we don't see it. We can't visualize how we are okay, so we feel like we're not okay. So they have to bring those things into the forefront of their mind with actual numbers, actual visualization of their cash flow, for example. And then if there is a problem, so for example, someone with a 2.3 million net worth could have a cash flow problem. If that net worth is all in a 401k in a house, for example, that can be a pretty big cash flow problem if their income pretty much matches their expenses. So any unexpected expense is going to be put on a credit card, for example, because they don't have liquid cash available to them. And so they're borrowing every time something happens. That could be a problem that they have, but without an awareness of where that net worth actually lies and how much is accessible to them, that creates that fear, and we can't solve a problem we can't see.
Yeah. So with those two things, getting an awareness of your money, including your cash flow, and also being able to name your fears and anxieties so that you can create a plan, what can Debt-Free Mom do to help them?
One of the first things I do when I work with someone who has this high net worth or high income and has this financial stress
is to first acknowledge that that is not abnormal, that they are not particularly bad at money compared to their income peers, for example. Because what happens is when, you know, when someone comes to us and wants us to build a budget for them and they have their income is $40,000 a year, they have financial stress, but they know why. Like they're very familiar with the idea that their paycheck is small and so they're struggling to make ends meet. When someone comes to us and asks for help with their budget and is a doctor and has, you know, $250,000 a year in income, they are not only stressed by their money, but they are both confused and ashamed. They are embarrassed to say that they need help with their money because they had the perception, again, that because of their income, they wouldn't be in this situation, and somehow they've gotten into that situation. So that would be the first thing, is to say you are just as much in a position of needing help with your money as anybody else. You're not automatically extra bad at money just because you have a high income and still need help. So that would be the first thing that I would say. And then the second thing would be to just move into that awareness and say, if you're too overwhelmed by what your numbers are and figuring out a path, and you feel like, okay, I've had years and years of trying to scrape together a plan, and I'm clearly not putting together the numbers in a way that makes me feel confident about my money, I would look at what their cash flow is. So I would set up a budget by pay period, by month, whatever their pay schedule is, to say, let's look at how much money is actually available to you, because our security with our money comes mostly from that gap between our income and expenses. It comes mostly from having a gap between our income and expenses and knowing what it is. And so building a budget for them that allows them to see real numbers, not just to say general relative terms like you make enough, or you have a decent amount, or you spend less than you make, but to say, hey, on each of your pay periods, you have about $600 left over. Let's decide what you want to do with that. That moves from fear to awareness to action. And so taking them through that process, and at the same time, like I said, recognizing that there's nothing to be extra ashamed about because they happen to have a high net worth and fear about money, can help to let go of that guilt so that they actually start to do something about it. Because a lot of times what I see is that people with high net worth or high income tend to spend a lot of time working in very maladaptive ways. They want to mask or hide their money struggles because people know that they are a lawyer, or people know that they own a successful business. And so they think, well, I have to drive the nice car. I have to go on a regular vacation. I have to not bring up financial issues with my friends because it will be this big red flag to them. It'll be too embarrassing. So when they realize that they are not alone, that high earners come to us all the time, that they can become aware of what those real numbers are, and they can take action steps to feel confident inside of their exact same income, that's kind of the path that I would walk them through.
Awesome. So if you are feeling anxious about your money, whether you have $2.3 million net worth, or like you said earlier, if you have a $2,000 net worth, the same principles apply. We can help you do that with a custom budget. Our team can build that for you and give you that crystal clear picture of your finances. So you can go to debtfreemom.co/custom and see all our options there. Sign up for one today and take steps toward confident budgeting that can alleviate your anxiety and help you make progress towards your goals.
Yeah. And one more thing I want to say is, which hopefully this has kind of come through just in our chat about it, is I tell people who are like, I'm too embarrassed to do something like that because someone would see my numbers. I've done this enough times that no one is going to be the best or the worst. And even if they are, I'm not going to remember. Like I have people all the time, they'll send me a message like, you did a custom budget for us last July and now we're doing this. And I have to like go back and look up like what's their name? What were they doing? Because we just do so many of them. So it's kind of like going to your doctor and being embarrassed to like talk to them about something. Not only are they like, that's their job, so they're not going to be worried about that, but I guarantee you that by the time they've done three more appointments, they've forgotten what your problem was or what your body looks like or whatever. I really feel the same way, as like I look at long list of debts and high incomes, or people are like, oh my gosh, I don't want to tell you how much I spend on restaurants. It's just numbers to me at this point. And so there's no judgment in having to come and say, this is my income, these are my expenses, and these are my problems. Like, because I'm disconnected from your personal experience, I don't have to go through like the guilt, embarrassment, fear. I just move right away into like, those are the numbers. Let's build a plan.
Awesome. Well, this has been a extended dance remix version of Financial Fortune Cookie. Had a longer conversation than we planned on, but I think it was really good. So stick around for next week's episode. We will have more stuff to say about money and helping you be confident about your budgeting.
Thanks for listening to the Debt-Free Mom podcast. If you want to join me as a guest on the show, go to dfmpodcast.com. The Debt-Free Mom podcast is hosted by me, Carly Hill, and is produced, edited, and mixed by Kyle Hill. Music for this episode was written by Kyle Hill. Hit subscribe wherever you're listening to join in with every new episode as we grow our confidence and contentment in our personal finances.